From Cafe, welcome to Cafe Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Ann Milgram.
How are you, Ann?
I'm good.
Dog days of August?
Yes, exactly. Summer. I love summer. How are you?
How am I? I'm the same. Every week it's the same.
Every day feels a little the same. I was working. I was on a work call on Saturday night and someone was apologizing. And I was like, you know, every day is Wednesday or Thursday. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know what day today is. Today, I think they're just days.
Yes.
I don't really know. So we got a lot of stuff to talk about. As we are recording on the morning of August 11th, there is an oral argument going on in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. The full court, I think we've mentioned this before, is now considering that whole issue in the saga of the case of Michael Flynn.
That's right. Remember, the D.C. Circuit made a ruling basically overturning the district court judge, who hadn't actually even ruled yet, but saying that the essentially compelling the district court to grant Flynn's motion to dismiss his case. And now the D.C. Circuit had voted to hear it en banc, meaning all the judges on the D.C. Circuit would hear it together. And that hearing is going on this morning. And as you and I have talked about, it's a really important matter. It's very, very unusual what the initial D.C. Circuit opinion did, which was basically grant something called a writ of mandamus, which is an extraordinary remedy that really...
Wait, what kind of remedy?
It's an extraordinary remedy.
Extraordinary remedy.
Yes, exactly. I can't say it differently.
You said that with no inflection. I don't even know what
you're doing.
That
is actually, that's the term of art for mandamus. That's the legal term. An extraordinary remedy.
Yeah, that's what I needed this morning, actually.
So we'll see what the court does, but I think that they will reverse the prior D.C. Circuit ruling. They'll send it back to the judge to hold hearings on whether or not the case should be dismissed. But we'll see. We'll know soon.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens, and we'll talk about it next week. So big news over the weekend, because Congress was not able to act, and people can decide who they want to blame for that. The president, it keeps getting reported, issued a series of executive orders. Can I give you a quiz?
Yes.
Are you ready? I didn't give you advance notice of this quiz.
No, I know. I like a surprise quiz.
So the president signed four documents. Which of the following things is in fact an executive order? Is it one of them? Is it two of them? Three of them? Four of them? Because the way it constantly gets reported is there are all these executive orders that some people are saying are unconstitutional. One of the things the president did was delay the payroll tax collection for those making under $104,000 or so. Extending unemployment aid, depending on how you count, by $300 or $400. The third thing was something having to do with evictions, and we'll talk about whether or not there's a moratorium on evictions or not. And then fourth, student loan payments being deferred for the rest of 2020. Which of those, Ann Milgram, for 500, is an executive order?
Well, Preet, there's only one executive order, and there are three memorandums. The executive order relates to housing evictions. It does not provide a moratorium on housing evictions. What it does do is direct the Secretary of HHS and others to look at the idea of doing a housing an eviction moratorium, which is the...
Wait, pause and claim your victory. You didn't even allow
me
to congratulate.
500 to me. Yes.
Yes. There is only one executive order. It's not executive orders. That's all. That's all I had to say. Now we can
That's
talk
right.
about it.
And here's the part that I find almost most fascinating is that the one thing that it looks like the president can do under his authority is declare a moratorium on housing evictions, because the federal government obviously operates federal mortgage lenders, Freddie Mae and Fannie Mae. That is a lot of the mortgages in the United States of America.
But not all.
Not all, but a lot, a significant number. So the president could actually act to essentially defer or say, we're not going to evict anyone within a certain period of time. He didn't do that, Preet. He just said, I want you to look at it. I want folks to look at it. And so this raises a lot of issues, but that's the one EO, which does essentially nothing. I know I was going to ask you, and I just want to be a little bit critical of the media for a second, because the initial sort of very strong take coming out was that the president issued four executive orders and they were unconstitutional. And I think that they might not actually accomplish anything, or there are enormous problems that might make them not lawful.
Ineffective.
But ineffective? Yes. Or you could challenge them and litigate and I think win in many instances. But it doesn't strike me as unconstitutional what the president did. And in fact, it's almost a little bit more sort of sneaky. I don't know if that's the right word, but what the president did was take grants of authority that Congress has made to him to have some ability to do things. And we can talk about some specific examples, but then he's not followed those specific grants. He's changed them to try to do what he wants to do.
Yeah, and because part of it is the fault of the president, because the president will speak very expansively about what he's doing. And he does this in every context all the time. And then you look at the fine print of the thing that he's done, and it's some fraction of what he suggested publicly. So with respect to the one executive order, the one EO that you mentioned with respect to evictions, which barely does anything, it basically calls for a meeting.
I like a meeting.
Yeah. I mean, meetings are good. It's like, yeah, I think HHS, they should do a podcast about evictions.
I'm only laughing because it's like, it's an EO is far stronger than a memorandum. People should understand that. Like, it's an executive order of the president of the United States. And as a rule, presidents do them when they have existing executive authority and they can't get Congress to do something, they try to take action through EOs. And sometimes they are controversial. Remember, you know, Obama issued EOs related to immigration that some Republicans argued were unlawful. And so it's not like a president has never used them.
Yeah. You know who one of those people was?
Who?
One of those people was Donald J. Trump.
Yes.
Who said,
true,
you don't govern by executive order, but we don't have to dredge up.
Until you do. Yes.
So on evictions, doesn't do very much. Not really unconstitutional. Let's pick another one. Unemployment aid?
Yes.
That's kind of complicated because, as I think people know, there are tens of millions of people who are unemployed because of the pandemic, or newly unemployed because of the pandemic. And they had been receiving, pursuant to a congressional bill that was passed into law, $600 a week from the federal government on top of whatever state aid they were getting.
Which was about $300 a week for states, so about $900 a week in total.
That came to an end, I believe, at the end of July. And the question was, could they extend it? And Democrats were saying, let's extend it at the same level. And it gets complicated. And Larry Kudlow himself was on television multiple times over the weekend, couldn't really explain it.
They're in much better shape today than they were three, 4 months ago.
So when will people see their first checks?
I don't want to be specific because you might hold me to it, as you should.
I learned nothing from his presentations about any of the provisions, but in particular this provision. And Trump said that he was advocating for an extension of that benefit of $400 per week. But if you read the fine print, it's really $300 potentially. And the states who are strapped would have to kick in 25% of that because of the authority that's being invoked in the memorandum. Do you follow any of this?
So here's what I follow. And I think it is worth a couple minutes of conversation about it because I feel like this is a really important thing. There are 30 million people who are on unemployment right now receiving benefits. Those benefits ended at the end of July. And the outcome will be catastrophic for our country. And so many of those folks have lost their jobs because of the pandemic and need the benefits to be able to, you know, pay bills. It relates directly to housing. Otherwise, they could be evicted. There are all kinds of sort of real people's ability to get food, to support their families. So what the president does is he basically takes money. And again, going back to a prior congressional statute that had authorized the president to have money at the Department of Homeland Security under FEMA, which of course is the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Their job is to respond to natural disasters. We had a tropical storm last week. There have been many hurricanes. Basically, the job of FEMA and the Disaster Relief Fund, which is a part of the money that the Homeland Security Department has, that money is specifically set aside for in case of emergency. And the reason it's done like that, and the reason it's, I don't want to call it a slush fund, but it's a large bucket of money. And it's done like that because it can take so long for the federal government to be able to authorize money to go to address a catastrophe or a disaster that they want DHS to have a bucket of money for FEMA just to be able to respond immediately. What the president has now done is basically said he's going to take $44 billion out of the disaster relief funds and use that to send an additional $400 a week to people. Actually, that would only be the $300 a week. Part of the statute that lets the president do this, take this, essentially use federal funds to respond to a disaster. So again, assume for a minute that there's a legitimate response that the government is making to like a hurricane or something like that, the states have to put in 25% matching funds. And that's where you get to this point where the president is basically saying, we'll give you $300 a week in disaster relief funds, but the states have to put in $100 a week for you. What becomes really critical here is that the president is using, there is a part of the Stafford Disaster Relief and Emergency Act. That's what provides for this disaster relief fund. There is a part of that that allows the president to provide, to quote, provide financial assistance under this section to an individual or household to address personal property, transportation, and other necessary expenses or serious needs resulting from the major disaster, close quotes. But that provision is not alone. There's also a provision as part of that law that says that people who are eligible for any other form of unemployment compensation cannot receive FEMA money, and basically caps the amount of money that people can get at what the state programs would allow. So basically, the president is, and I thought that there was a great piece that was written by Georgetown Law professor David Super, where he basically said the president is both disrespecting Congress's power of the purse, because the Constitution says that Congress is the one that decides how money gets spent, and state legislatures that obviously should get to decide how they spend their money. So it's both sort of an attack on the Constitution and federalism at the same time.
So unconstitutional?
So I think...
I thought you said that's not unconstitutional.
Well, the reason people are talking about it, I don't think it is unconstitutional for the following reason.
But it's an attack on the Constitution.
Right. I think it is an attack on the fact that if we go back to the way the Constitution is written and the norms, the norm is that Congress has the power of the purse. Congress is the one. All spending bills have to start in the U.S. House of Representatives per the United States Constitution. What Congress has done, and let's be clear on this, you and I talked about this a couple of years ago, but Congress has given the president enormous authority in some areas. This is one where Congress has given the president money to spend for disaster relief. It is not contemplated to be done or used the way the president is doing it now. You and I should, obviously, we're in hurricane season. They're talking about taking $44 billion out of money that's supposed to be used for hurricanes. And we've seen, you know, we've seen serious hurricanes and flooding in places like Texas, in the Panhandle, in Hurricane Sandy years ago. So Hurricane Katrina in Louisiana years ago. So that money is essential money for Homeland Security purposes. And we've given the president money to spend for that. What he's now doing, and by the way, if there was a hurricane and people lost their jobs, there is money that's contemplated. Again, there are a lot of restrictions on it, and the president is not following the restrictions that the law sets out. But there is a bucket of money that under those circumstances could be used. Here, the problem is, number one, he's essentially robbing Peter to pay Paul. And number two, that this is, it really is, like, he's not following the law, the Stafford Act, that sort of sets out what the president can do and can't do. And number three, and probably most importantly, is that the way that this is done and should be done is through congressional negotiations. The House of Representatives wanted to give people who are unemployed $600 a week. The Republicans, the president said, I want to give them $200 a week. And Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, Republican from Kentucky, said, I don't want to get involved in this negotiation. He basically stepped out, and the president used his power to do this and to do a number of other things. And I don't think it's a, I mean, I'm curious to know what you think, Preet, but a lot of things, you know, conveniently expire in December. A lot of the deferrals where people wouldn't have to pay student loans, all those things, or payroll taxes, those things expire, those deferrals expire at the end of December.
I don't know. I don't think it's unconstitutional. But with respect to that question, you know, people are all over the map. And some people, I won't identify them, sort of in a knee-jerk way, in elective office have said it's unconstitutional. Others probably have been advised better and think it's a closer question, and they're not sure. And they have said, I think my former boss, I think Senator Schumer said,
well, you know, I'll leave that up to the attorneys.
Which is probably a smart dodge. But at the end of the day, with respect to a provision like that, I don't understand exactly how a challenge in court would even work. Unless someone runs in there and tries to prevent money from being given to folks who need it and gets some kind of injunction, money starts going out, and then at the end of the day, weeks or months from now, there's an adjudication against the president's power in that regard, What are you going to do? You're going to take the money back from all the millions of Americans who got a few hundred dollars a week? That just doesn't seem workable to me. So
you know where I think the litigation comes? I think the litigation comes. Well, it's also politically very clever of the president, right? Because he's essentially forcing the hand of the Democrats who want people to get more money. He's forcing them to basically go into court and say, to basically litigate against people getting $400 a month. They obviously wouldn't be litigating against it, really. They're litigating for them to have the power to negotiate, but the optics are obviously pretty bad. But here's where I think it gets, where I think you potentially get into litigation, is that states are, almost every state you see is talking about laying people off, cutting essential social programs, cutting essential services for people in the state. And that is because the pandemic has caused an economic, you know, disaster in the United States, and states have deployed a lot of resources. They have, obviously, we just talked about, made a lot of commitments to paying unemployment. So I'm not saying that states won't pay that $100 a week, but I think that there's a fair amount that states could basically say around, you know, you can't compel us to basically pay in for this right now. We want to do it separately. So that's where I think, and then it raises this really weird question to me of, are you going to have certain states saying, yeah, we'll pay the $100 a week to get the $300 from the federal government? And then other states say, no, we're not going to pay the $100 a week.
I mean, I think it depends on the state's wherewithal and what their status is and what their budget situation is. And I think it depends on those things. And then there are two other memoranda. One related to the payroll tax. And as people know, you know, the payroll tax is paid both by the employee and by the employer. There's been relief on that for a period of time. And the president proposes delaying the payroll tax collection for people making less than $4,000 every 2 weeks. So that's about $104,000 a year, if I did the math correctly. What should be clear to everyone is it's not a cancellation of that tax. It's not full forever relief from that tax. It's just a delay. It'll come due later. But what's interesting politically about that is the president seems not to like the payroll tax. And one of his press people said the president is seriously considering, I guess, when he gets reelected, eliminating the payroll tax altogether. Well, that would be interesting because, as people may know, it is the payroll tax that funds Social Security.
And Medicare.
Yeah. And it sounds well and good and nice to say, hey, let's cancel this tax. It doesn't sound so well and good and nice to say, basically, we're going to defund Social Security.
Yeah. The thing my feeling on the payroll tax is that it's like, do you remember Popeye and Wimpy?
Popeye the Sailor Man?
Popeye the Sailor Man. Let's bring it back. I love spinach now. I did not love spinach as a kid. But do you remember Wimpy? I will gladly pay you tomorrow for a hamburger today. So this is like the Wimpy provision. Like the president is trying to basically keep money in people's paychecks so they vote for him for reelection. I'm sorry to be crass, but this is what I see is basically like.
And you're so crass.
I know. Keep your money today and pay me tomorrow, right? And so what I call the so-called Wimpy provision would basically put people on the hook in January for essentially 4 months, 4.5 months of taxes that they haven't paid to the federal government. So that is a really, and again, it's sort of like the short-term gain. You get money in your pocket. In January, it all comes due. There's absolutely no sense or guarantee in my mind that the pandemic has ended by January and that people had the money to pay this back. Nor do I think that that's how Americans work. I mean, I think a lot of people live paycheck to paycheck, particularly right now. But like, what do you make of the thing, Preet, that a lot of people are saying it doesn't matter because businesses are the ones that withhold these taxes when they're paying people, and they're not going to stop withholding these taxes.
Yeah, I mean, I think people have to make a business decision about whether they withhold or not. And you can get yourself into a deep hole if you don't, and you spend all that money now with the understanding that you're going to have to pay it later. I mean, sometimes giving people a short-term benefit is a problem. I mean, I think the same thing might be true of student loans. If you say to somebody, you know, I know it's difficult. And again, it depends on the circumstances. And some people really, really, really do need the short-term relief. But for other people, you know, as a psychological matter, you don't have to pay something. You spend that money. And then all of a sudden, your huge bill becomes due in a few months because you haven't gotten forgiveness. You've only gotten delay. That can be a bigger deal in the future. then paying a little bit at a time as you go along.
Yeah, I mean, the difference with the student loans, I think that this one is lawful. I think that the education department has this authority to defer or cancel student loan payments to the federal government. Again, you know, some people have private loans that wouldn't be impacted by this, but to the extent that students, and again, a lot of students will have at least part of their loans will be owned by the federal government. This idea would be that, you know, the debt isn't canceled, and it's basically not canceling it. It's just pushing back. They would temporarily cancel interest payments, and principal payments would come back on December 31st. Full payments would restart on January 1st. I think what the question in my mind is how they do it. If they just extend the term of the loan and don't compound the interest, then there is value in probably for students of any length of time that, particularly students who aren't working or who are in difficult circumstances, to have this option, saying essentially, let's extend it by 6 months. We're going to extend the loan term by 6 months. We're not going to increase the interest payments. We're just going to basically, you know, have a hiatus for individuals who are going through a lot. In fact, you could do it for a year, whatever, until the sort of pandemic, or at least we came back to some normalcy in our world. But so I do think it's a little bit different depending on how they approach it. But again, we don't know how they're going to approach it. It just gives, you know, basically tells the education secretary to start doing this and set some timelines.
One other executive action we should mention, because we talked about some of this in the last week or two, with respect to TikTok, that website that the kids seem to love, the president did issue an executive order on August 6th under the National Emergencies Act and what we call IEPA, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, in connection with TikTok. The order says, I, Donald Trump, President of the United States of America, find that additional steps must be taken to deal with the national emergency with respect to the information and communications technology and services supply chain declared in a previous executive order. That's where he takes his authority from. And he goes on to say, at this time, action must be taken to address the threat posed by one mobile application in particular, TikTok. Now, it gets very complicated what kind of action will take place. And as we mentioned previously, there's a process that is already underway by a committee called CFIUS that examines from a national security perspective whether or not a certain, you know, combination or merger or purchase is right for the United States, and it can demand divestiture. By this executive order, the president's sort of saying, do what I say, and he's injecting himself in a way that could be judged to be interference. There's also still this potential deal with Microsoft. Unclear what's going to happen.
Yeah, and I think the other point is that the executive order isn't just for TikTok. It's also for WeChat, which is also a Chinese company. The parent company is known as Tencent. Tencent has widespread investments in the United States that include WeChat, but they also own parts of, they own 5% of Tesla. They have full ownership of Riot Games that makes League of Legends video game. They have a minority stake in Activision Blizzard that makes the game, the video game Call of Duty. They have 12% of Snap, the developer of Snapchat. They own part of Spotify, some of Universal Music Group. And so what that divestiture would look like is even more complicated than TikTok, where TikTok's parent company is in China, but TikTok and a lot of the pieces are in the United States. And so the idea of this applying to WeChat as well, this is complicated, and we can continue to follow it. But I suspect that there will be litigation that the companies, both Tencent and ByteDance, considered litigating it. This process does look strange and outside the normal sort of channels that it would usually happen. And so, you know, it will continue to be something I think that we'll have to keep an eye on.
So let's talk about the courts. There is a case that we have talked about before relating to Congress's subpoenas of the former White House counsel, Don McGahn. And we'll talk about it. And it, I think, also was a little bit of a foreshadowing of what might happen in the Michael Flynn case that we mentioned at the beginning of the show. Now, people may remember that the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit ruled against the House 2-1. And usually, Court of Appeals arguments are panels of three judges in that court. And by 2-1, they basically said, you know, it's really not for us to get involved in a dispute between the House of Representatives, Congress, on the one hand, and the president, the executive branch, on the other hand. And what I think is fascinating, if you have a 2-1 majority, when you have a three-person panel, obviously, that position wins. And the position was that they should stay out of it and let Congress and the White House work it out between themselves. Then when it gets kicked to the whole court, there are 11 judges on the D.C. Circuit. Two of them recuse themselves for having worked in the executive branch before. The ruling was what? 7-2. So every judge in the circuit who was in a position to vote on this question disagreed with the two-member majority of the first three-person panel. So it's the luck of the draw that they lost, that the House lost in the first instance. If they literally, I think as a mathematical matter, if they had gotten any other combination of three judges, they would have prevailed in the first instance, right?
Are you asking me to do a statistical analysis of that? That sounds complicated, but yes, in general, yes, I agree with you. Some mathematician and statistician will write in and explain to us what the possibilities are.
But it just suggests you can have skewed decisions. I mean,
do you know what got me, Preet? There's like more than, I don't know, there's millions of ways in which you can make configurations with six Legos. So I start thinking, like, if you have six Legos and can make millions of configurations, what happens with seven judges?
If you have only two judges, you're going to be with the White House's position.
Right.
And in my hypothetical, you have any combination that does not have one of those two judges.
Yes,
and every
I think
other
you're right.
Judge.
When you say it like that, you've won me over. But you know what else is interesting is that in the 2-1 original decision, right? It was Judge Griffith wrote the opinion, Judge Henderson concurred. Those are the two judges who are now in the minority on the en banc decision. The judge that dissented in the initial opinion, Judith Rogers, she wrote the opinion of the court in the 7-2 decision. So she had dissented. Now she writes the majority opinion. And, you know, what's interesting also, and a lot of folks sort of, I think, noted this when the Supreme Court ruled recently in the Mazars case, the case that the Supreme Court addressed the question of the subpoenas to Mazars that had Donald Trump's financial records. They basically, you know, they had a conversation about standing and what can go forward and what can't. And so here, what the court is basically saying is, like, this is clearly falls within the courts having standing to hear this matter. And so, you know, a lot of people sort of indicated that they thought it would happen after Mazars. But I think it still is a really important decision.
The other thing, again, not to get ahead of ourselves, because we'll be discussing this next week, because as we mentioned earlier, there's an argument going on with respect to what happens to the Michael Flynn case. But there you had a decision also where you had a three-judge panel that ruled against the district court judge and in favor of Michael Flynn's lawyers to issue the mandamus. I think this doesn't bode well for the Flynn position. It's a different issue. There are different, you know, matters involved.
Yeah, I agree with you.
It just shows you that is another example of a thing where lots of experts, you and I included, if we can dare call ourselves experts, thought that decision was wrong and out of step. And there are members of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals who on some of these matters seem out of step with the full court. So I think that the Flynn lawyers should be worried about what's happening there.
The question I have, though, is so basically what this says is that the judiciary can compel McGahn to come forward. But now we're in a position where McGahn can still claim privileges. Like, he can still litigate executive privilege. He was the White House counsel. It's not like McGahn is going to come in and have to testify to everything. He can still litigate parts of it. We are now, I mean, remember, this goes back to the 2016 election and the Mueller investigation. McGahn was an important witness in that investigation. We're now about to have the 2020 presidential election. I mean, it has taken so long for this to wind its way through the court. And McGahn, like, is he going to testify before the election, Preet?
No, I think a lot of these things will be of less interest to a lot of people as the months wear on.
The one thing that is important, though, is it does set a very clear precedent that if the Judiciary Committee subpoenas a witness, they have the ability to invoke, you know, specific privileges, but they can't do essentially what the White House was doing here, which is to completely ignore a congressional subpoena for a witness.
Yeah, and the court also emphasized something that was underemphasized in the earlier opinion and in some other opinions that we've discussed. And that is, not only does Congress have a real role in enacting legislation, obviously they are the ones who enact legislation, and they need the ability to do that. They need to engage in fact-finding to do it. So there's some, you know, legitimate legislative purpose that's being vindicated. But also, oversight. Of course, you know, it cannot conduct effective oversight of the federal government without detailed information about the operations of its departments and agencies. And so there's a recognition of this other role, not the primary role, but maybe a secondary role, I would think you could say, of the Congress in engaging in oversight of a separate and distinct branch of government that justifies the seeking of information. And, you know, the details
and that's important too, because
negotiated. But yeah, it's very important.
Yeah.
And that's been completely cast aside in arguments made by the president's lawyers before.
What I think is also important about the point you just made is that it is short of impeachment inquiries. And so I think that the court was careful to note that there were a number of ways in which Congress is entitled to get information, to pass laws, to do executive oversight, and during impeachment inquiries. And the McGahn subpoena was issued prior to the vote to start the impeachment inquiry in the House. What's important about it is that it doesn't say that all matters have to, it's only for impeachment that you can get this type of witness testimony. It basically points out all three functions of Congress, which again, to your point, I think is really important going forward for Congress to have real oversight over the executive branch. Otherwise, it stops being a co-equal branch of government.
So here's a question from a listener that gets us into our next topic. This is from Mary, who writes, "Love your show. I understand it's not a federal case, but I would love to hear your take on the legal action taken by the New York Attorney General, Letitia James, against the NRA. Thanks, Mary." Big action taken by Tish James. Before we get to what she did with respect to the NRA, my observation is the evening before, the Attorney General's office in New York issued a press release saying there was going to be an announcement of national significance the next morning, like I think like 11 a.m. And what's interesting to me, and we can discuss what it says about the state of members of the public and their need and desire and wish for some savior to deliver them from Donald Trump, Twitter, social media, news accounts, blogs were awash with a frenzy that here at long last was a state attorney general who's going to do something like indict the president of the United States.
Which was bizarre to begin with, because the state of New York AG does not have that power. The state AG has very limited criminal power.
People cling to the hope. They cling to the hope of Bob Mueller, to whom they lit candles. They have clung to the hope of the 25th Amendment. You know, even though we're on the eve of an election, it's less than 90 days away, lots of people still think, well, you know, maybe there can be a lightning strike from heaven from some prosecutor's office, by analogy, and get rid of the president or harm the president. The only thing that's going to get rid of the president is an election that is overwhelming in November.
Yes. Yes, I think you're right that people were sort of, there was also a lot of weird speculation about it relating to the Manhattan DA's investigation. And it really didn't make sense. And so that day, Tish James, the New York AG, announces that she's brought a civil action under her authority, essentially as overseeing charitable organizations in New York State. So I oversaw this charitable organizations when I was AG in New Jersey, and this is a pretty common AG role. There's a law in New York that's basically that looks at, you know, overseeing not-for-profits and estates and basically, you know, the public charities laws. And so there are a number of things that groups that want to be registered as charities have to do and follow. And I think we should break this into a few different buckets, but one of the things that I was pretty stunned by, and some of this had been reported before, but was the extent of the fraud and the level of corruption of the executive vice president, Wayne LaPierre, the general counsel, John Fraser, the former chief financial officer, Woody Phillips, and the former chief of staff, Joshua Powell. There's like this, and this has been an 18-month investigation. There's been, I don't even know how they got to this amount, but millions of dollars spent in town cars and travel expenses, travel consultants, basically all gifts, all these, a safari that Wayne LaPierre went on with his wife in Africa, all these sort of sweetheart contracts where they got no bid contracts to continue consulting relationships with the NRA. I mean, just the kind of stuff that you and I would look at in any type of financial fraud case. And it would just be like, you know, alarm bells would be ringing because no legitimate justification, no board approvals, personal use. I mean, the kinds of things that make very, very strong criminal prosecutions. This is not a criminal prosecution, though I think obviously there's a lot of evidence here of financial fraud against the members of the NRA. Essentially, basically, I mean, the accusations really are that people were paying dues to the NRA and the leadership, the sort of executive leadership, was stealing that money for their own personal benefit.
Can I make an aside that's not about the law?
Yeah.
Because obviously, you know, the NRA is a controversial organization and people feel strongly about gun regulation and about how much influence the NRA has over politics. So there's a political aspect to all of this. Is it odd to you that given how concrete the allegations are and how much documentary evidence there appears to be, whether or not at the end of the day, the NRA is dissolved, whether or not at the end of the day there's a criminal case, I'm hearing the deafening silence of all sorts of supporters of the NRA, including people who pay dues to the NRA, the silence of them not being upset that the leadership seems to have been bilking the organization for personal benefit and lining their own pockets and living a lavish life. Where is that outrage? You know, the complaint on its face has nothing to do with guns. It has nothing to do with the policy positions of the NRA. It's a pure and simple fraud, pocket-lining enterprise by the leadership, especially Wayne LaPierre, at the NRA. There's no political aspect to it, at least in the text of the complaint. You would imagine that if the same kind of thing was happening at the head of any other nonprofit organization, liberal, independent, think tank, conservative, whatever, and there were credible allegations of this kind of fleecing of the organization, that the rank and file would go bananas. And not only the rank and file, but other public officials as well, whatever side of the political spectrum they're on. And instead, in the face of these detailed allegations, you have people like the governor of Arkansas, Hutchinson, saying, hey, if you don't like New York, come to Arkansas. You know, a welcoming gesture.
Or was it Texas also?
I think multiple states. I think multiple states. What is the reason why people who are otherwise supportive of the mission of the NRA, and you can be or cannot be, seem to be so dismissive of these? Why can't they be mad at Wayne LaPierre and the leadership and want them replaced and want them to be held accountable and then separately support the mission of the NRA? I don't really follow
right.
that.
So I think my reaction to the whole thing, well, my first reaction is where I started, which is just that it is a pretty stunning level of abuse and theft from the organization, right? I mean, there are just so many different examples detailed in the complaint of ways in which the sort of four C-suite level executives of this organization, forget politics for a minute, this could be a business, this is a nonprofit organization, the way that they essentially raided the organization for their own personal benefit and profit. And it is really, really significant that they have taken out so much money. They've been just in constant legal battles related to this. They've spent, I think it was something like $100 million on litigation. And so they're essentially bankrupt now, as opposed to being an organization that once exerted huge amounts of political influence. And they are a political organization. We should say that. They're C4, and their right to be a political organization is very, very clear, right? So, you know, there are political organizations on the left, political organizations on the right. This happens to be a gun organization. And I agree, like, just putting aside how we feel about that for a second, the charities law really is meant to be sort of evenly applied. And the fact that people don't understand the level of abuse is troubling to me. The one question I will ask you, Preet, and the one thing in my mind, I mean, I think that there's two really fair questions that people are asking about the litigation. One, and I want to come back to this, but whether or not the AG should have sought to dissolve it. And I think that that is a really important thing for us to discuss. But the other piece that I was a little bit stuck on is that if I were sitting in my chair as AG, and there were times that we basically said that charities, we were revoking their license in New Jersey, that they weren't going to be allowed to basically go out, that we were going to, you know, sort of require reorganizations and such. I mean, this is, you know, charitable organizations can very much take advantage of people for all the reasons we know. But this investigation went on for 18 months. And then they drop it in the middle of August before the presidential election. So whether or not the investigation is political or not, the timing just doesn't feel right to me. And I personally think I would have waited. And I wonder how you feel about this. I think I would have waited till November, particularly given what is a very aggressive and it looks to me potentially legally supportable ask to dissolve the entire organization. Like that is the ultimate sort of hammer under the charities laws to basically say, we're dissolving you because we don't think there's any version, there's no way for new leadership to come in and fix this.
Remember, the New York Attorney General's office already did such a thing with respect to the Trump Foundation.
Yeah, I think it's a little different though. I think it's different.
Look, on the question of, not everyone's going to like this, on the question of whether or not it was legitimate and appropriate to go after the NRA in this way and on these grounds, I think lawful, not unethical. But there is a question about the propriety of it Because while it is true, as I said earlier, that nothing on the face of the complaint, in the text of the complaint, is about the nature of the NRA's work or its ideology or, you know, the gun rights, Second Amendment work that it does, no logical human being can think that did not enter into the mindset of the Attorney General of the state of New York. And you can say that's okay or that's not okay, but there's a piece in the Washington Post by Ruth Marcus, which really made me think about this. And Ruth Marcus begins by saying, she's a noted liberal, I think fair to say. She begins her op-ed by saying, quote, "I loathe the National Rifle Association. With its reflexive opposition to even the mildest gun regulation, it is complicit in the deaths of thousands," end quote. I sort of feel the same way.
Me too. I feel the same.
And lots of people on one side of the political spectrum feel the same way about the NRA. It is, I think, a harmful organization that has strayed very, 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 very far from its original mission that related to gun safety and some other things. But Ruth Marcus also then says, quote, "The NRA has a First Amendment right to its misguided understanding of the Second. Forcing its dissolution has disturbing implications, made even more disturbing by the fact that the Attorney General seeking that step is a Democrat who vowed during her campaign to, quote, take on the NRA, end quote, and labeled it a terrorist organization. In this country, we don't go after entities because of what they advocate," end quote. Not everyone's going to like that position, because there are people who say, well, you go after an organization because there was fraud, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I wonder if people would feel the same way if you had an aggressive attorney general of a state going after a liberal organization when they really didn't care that much about fraud at the organization. I mean, in some ways, some people who I've seen on social media who don't like the NRA is like, you know, good for them. Those suckers deserved that kind of looting of their own money. And if a complaint against an organization whose politics you disagree with is a pretext for trying to dissolve something for that reason, because you disagree with them, is that right and proper or not?
Right. And I think, look, I think you're raising exactly the right questions. And I also read that piece by Ruth Marcus and thought it was powerful because, I mean, she's asking a very important question, which is basically saying it's not about whether you agree or disagree with them. And I know a lot of people will feel differently, but the charities laws apply regardless of politics. And organizations like the NRA, C4s, they're equivalent organizations on the left and the right. The thing I kept thinking about as somebody who's overseen charities is that as a rule, you know, there were instances when we took the most aggressive action, it was instances where charities had already been given an opportunity to reform or they'd been identified as being problematic and flagged for and basically told you're going to lose your status unless you do this.
Right. Like recidivists, like the people who are recidivists,
yes,
right?
Exactly. So I'm not saying in any way that they had to give a warning because this is rampant. But in terms of the remedy, to me, the question really is you have people who are members of the NRA who are giving dues and by all accounts, including in the complaint, are not, they haven't basically agreed to have the executive steal money from them and use the money for their personal gain. They basically are seeking to have an organization, you know, basically do a certain mission. And so it just isn't clear to me that you can't require, I mean, the sort of first step in the complaint is dissolve, the big ask is dissolve the organization, but the sort of subsidiary ask is remove those four people from their positions and have forced them to pay restitution and pay the money back. So I think the question in my mind, if I were sitting in the AG's office, would have been if you essentially, what if you require those four people to leave, pay back the money, and you do a monitorship of the organization? So basically, you're going to be able to like, they can put new leadership in, but you're going to basically monitor it for the next 5 years to make sure that it functions in a way that's consistent with all the charities laws. Could you actually allow the organization to function? And that to me is sort of where I think I would have started or thought about it. And again, I'm not saying it's not lawful to seek dissolution. This is rampant fraud, but you are setting a precedent that the answer to basically thefts by the senior executive committee, and look, we've seen this in businesses, we've seen this in charities, like this is, it does happen, that the answer is to completely dissolve it. There are some folks who have suggested that James might have put it in as a negotiation tactic. I certainly, I doubt that, and I hope it's not true, because that's not the right, you know, I just would not agree with that at all. If she put it in basically thinking, well, I'm going to ask for dissolution and then I'm going to settle for the removal of the four.
Public law offices are supposed to seek what they think is right and just and not engage in that kind of maneuvering, right?
And I should say clearly, I don't take those allegations, those sort of assertions at face value, but a lot of sort of smart lawyers are writing pieces saying, well, this is probably to get a settlement. And I don't agree with it. And if it were true, which again, I don't think it is, I would be disappointed in that because again, you should ask for the remedy that you think is fair. So look, we'll continue to watch this. I also sort of wonder in my mind, Preet, like, did they give this information to law enforcement? Like, it feels to me like these are cases that are ripe also for criminal prosecutions.
Yeah, I mean, people say that all the time. And, you know, I had a civil division and a criminal division, and some things you just can't prove beyond a reasonable doubt, and you can't prove willfulness. And I imagine, and we didn't talk about it, we haven't seen an answer yet from Wayne LaPierre and the executives and the NRA. They're not going to surrender. Presumably, they have some defenses based on the bylaws of the organization. And even though some of the spending was exorbitant, I imagine that they will argue, maybe, you know, not credibly, but they will attempt to argue that these expenses were approved by the organization and deemed necessary by the membership, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And if you have some, you know, even face-saving defense like that, it makes a criminal prosecution even harder. I just want to say one thing that's the flip side of what I said before when we were talking about the Ruth Marcus op-ed. So it is true on the one hand that you just want to be a little careful about going after an organization whose politics you don't like and whose actions you have criticized substantively because it looks a little bit odd. On the other hand, it is also important to say that if there's rampant malfeasance going on in an organization, just because you disagree with them and just because it's a conservative organization, just because people might say, hey, this is a proxy for you're trying to destroy an organization you disagree with, just because those things are true doesn't mean you get immunity from accountability. It's not a get out of jail free card, right? So, you know, there are two sides to the coin. You can't, you know, sort of go through life as the NRA thinking with impunity, we have a First Amendment right to do whatever. And so we can pillage and loot and steal from our membership because people like Letitia James and others shouldn't be able to go after us because they don't like the substance of what we do. And they don't like our interpretation of the Second Amendment. It doesn't work that way either.
I agree.
And so I guess all I'm saying is you just need to be careful if you're a lawyer in the public trust, as to what you decide to do, how you decide to do it, so that people have faith that things are being done for the right reason.
Well, this is my point on timing, right? This is my point on timing, because I think that the public having faith is really important, that, you know, she holds an enormous amount of power on behalf of the people of the state of New York, of which I am one. And I, you know, what you want to make sure is that that power is exercised in a fair fashion. And so my feeling is exactly right. Like, I believe the NRA should be held, like, the organization has to be held accountable. This is rampant fraud and abuse. The question in my mind is that it just feels much more political because of the timing. And I would guess that, you know, they said August is a deadline to get this case out because September, October looks even more political. But it's still, in my view, it's too close to the election. It feels too political for a variety of reasons. And I would have preferred to have seen this 2 months ago or at the end of November. And I think that would have sort of, you know, changed the calculation a little bit of how people are reviewing the request. Again, I think it's totally legitimate to seek the dissolution of a charity, and it happens across America frequently. The question is sort of, you know, is it the right thing to do here, and what's the right outcome? And I want to make just one quick final note, which is, people have compared this to the Trump Foundation, where Barbara Underwood, Attorney General James's predecessor, sought the dissolution of the Trump Foundation, and the Trump Foundation agreed. That was a very small amount of money. That was, relatively speaking, that was a small foundation. And remember, they don't have constituents. It's not a membership organization. Whereas here, the challenge here is that the NRA is a membership organization. Like it or not, there are people who believe in the organization and pay dues and are seeking to have an organization that furthers their interests. And so there is, in my mind, a very large distinction in terms of how you think about dismantling a charity when you have members who have interest in what is a legitimate goal that the organization is not fulfilling lawfully, right? And so that to me, makes it different.
Yes, I totally agree with that. My question is, and maybe they don't have the ability to speak, I'd like to know what the membership thinks. You would think there would be like outrage. You think you'd read articles with quotes from rank and file dues payers at the NRA saying, I'm horrified and I want them to get the hell out.
I'm going to tell you what I think. And I would love to be wrong about this. I think that they are probably both horrified by, or they should be horrified by what Wayne LaPierre has done. But I think that the move to dissolve the organization has become, the right has now galvanized around this and is playing offense around the Democratic political overreach by the New York Attorney General. And so that basically, they're using that as fodder to say they just hate you, you know, Democrats hate you and your organization.
Or they don't believe it. Or they,
exactly.
Or, you know, or yeah. People have such blinders on about the NRA, like some people do with other organizations on both sides of the aisle, that they either don't believe it, they think it's exaggerated. And even if it is true, what Tish James is doing is more terrible than what Wayne LaPierre did, as you said.
Right. That's what I sort of think. And again, I'm not agreeing with it at all, but I think it's the spin. And if you watch the media cycle around this, it was on the left very much, it's great, you're going to dissolve the NRA. And on the right, it was, this is an incredible overreach to try to dissolve an organization, a membership organization. By the way, one other point that shouldn't be lost on folks is that the litigation surrounding this, again, the NRA has been just enmeshed in litigation for the past basically 2 years. It will have an enormous cost. Wayne LaPierre will seek to have the organization pay his legal fees, as will the three others. And so this is going to mire, it's just the organization itself is going to, in my view, cease to function in many ways because this type of litigation will take a long time, cost an absolute fortune to litigate, and will be at a large expense to the organization. As you know, and I would expect that, you know, what we usually see from the NRA in terms of political ads, political donations during an election cycle, that will be dramatically changed because they're basically now going to have to litigate. They're going to litigate all this for a while.
I think you can fundraise off the fact that you have an existential threat. All right, so Anne, we got to go and follow what's going on with that Michael Flynn hearing. So we can report
exactly.
Back on.
Talk to you very soon, Preet. Take care. Please send us your questions.
Talk to you next week. That's it for this week's Insider Podcast. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Anne Milgram. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior audio producer is David Tatasciore. And the cafe team is Matthew Billy, David Curlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Calvin Lord, Noah Azulai, and Jeff Eisenman. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.